Welcome to After Action, true stories of the Diplomatic Security Service. I'm your host, Damaris Garcia. DSS protects State Department people, facilities, and information around the world. When diplomatic relations go south, that includes evacuating a U.S. embassy. With us today, Supervisory Special Agent Kareem Parson, who's going to take us to those final days at the U.S. Embassy in Caracas. Welcome, Kareem, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Damaris, and it's a pleasure to be here.
So take us through those final days in Caracas and your experience there.
In early 2019, after Nicolas Maduro, Hugo Chavez's hand-picked successor in Venezuela, as president in Venezuela, had won a sham election, widely understood by most of the world that it was a sham election. And so shortly after his inauguration in early January, he made a statement that any country, any nation who did not support his presidency or did not believe in the legitimacy of his presidency, he would ask them to leave. Of course, the United States government did not and does not believe in the legitimacy of his regime. Our folks were asked to leave. And it's important to note that we, in coordination and discussion with the legitimate president at the time, or the recognized legitimate leader, Juan Guaido, decided it would be best for us early on to get our non-essential personnel out.
And how long had you been already in Caracas when this started happening?
Yeah, at that point, I'd arrived in Caracas in late July. So I had arrived with the hope that I would do 2 years. After some discussion, the possibility of a third year. In reality, I got about 7.5 months.
Tell me a little bit about the situation in Venezuela leading up to this situation.
It was a country in crisis. It is still a country in crisis. And so at the time, you have just an extreme scarcity of resources, extremely high crime, and yet no reporting through most official media. So we're counting on NGOs to sort of tell us what they could tell us, but you don't have a real sense of the crime situation, the danger. So that's a problem because you have to factor that into your risk mitigation strategy. Also, you had, at one point, we had a power outage over 80% of the country, to include Caracas. And so with that and everything else going on, there's obviously the concerns for looting, rioting, and that sort of thing. It didn't turn out, that didn't happen. But it was a concern, and we had to adjust our plan to take that into that possibility into account. And also, the situation at the airport. Flights were very frequently delayed due to the security situation. There were very few flights in and out of Venezuela, and that matters to us because that was our primary way out. So one of the things we had to do was essentially a route reconnaissance of our alternative, which is over a big mountain and along the coastline.
Before you got the notice to shut down the embassy, what else was the regional security office working on?
The beauty of our work is that our mission never changes. We're looking across a variety of threat domains as encapsulated in our security environment threat list. And we're looking across those threat domains. We're taking information in and we're factoring that into our planning and operational considerations for all of our programs. But some notable things we were working on was we had a ARSOI, an Assistant Regional Security Officer for Investigations, to run our overseas criminal investigations program. The focus is protecting the integrity of the U.S. passport and visa system. So at that time, our agent, my good friend Duran Coates, was investigating a very horrible child sex trafficking ring. All of the perpetrators were in Venezuela. The victims were in Venezuela. Some really tough evidence that he had to deal with. And so he packaged that information up to give to the federal police in Venezuela. And after 9 attempts, they still refused to take that investigation on. And it's like, our point was, these are Venezuelan children as victims. So tough, but that was one of the things we were working on. Another investigative incident was high profile U.S. journalists traveled to Venezuela to interview Maduro. It was an approved interview, started with a very aggressive line of questioning. Maduro left the interview, and then at that point, the security forces separated the team, the journalist team, from their equipment, escorted them back to their hotel, very intimidating, very heavy hand, and the embassy was able to negotiate their deportation. So our team, our ARSOI and his team, were able to first advance the route from the hotel to the airport to ensure that it was safe and free of threats, coordinate at the airport to ensure a smooth, like seamless entry, cleared entrance into the airport, coordinate with the airlines to minimize that journalist and his team's time on the ground and get them out of the country as quickly as possible to minimize the potential for anything else bad to happen.
Were there any threats, direct threats, against the embassy during that time?
So we're always preparing and planning for that possibility. There was one instance where a 120-person motorcycle gang that was really a proxy of one of the Venezuelan politicians rolled through the neighborhood and passed the embassy. And again, understanding the potential for the situation, we reached out to our local police contacts who by far had far fewer motorcycles, but they gave us what they had. They responded. We pulled our people back off the perimeter, and it ended up being not an issue. The motorcycle gang kept moving on. The police were out there. They had control of the situation, and we mitigated the potential threat. But it was certainly meant to intimidate or send a message.
Can you talk us through what's the process of closing a U.S. embassy?
Well, it's a lot. And what I learned is that a lot of people outside of the embassy obviously weigh in and, in fact, in many cases, direct what happens. First of all, it's about getting everybody a shared understanding of the situation. So the front office was excellent. Our chargé d'affaires, Jimmy Story, was excellent in setting up town halls and in talking very candidly with the U.S. personnel and with our Venezuelan colleagues about what the situation was, what our efforts were, and what we were going to try to do to keep everyone secure and safe and, frankly, focused on the mission as we still tried to conduct diplomacy. So that was a large part of it, was just communication. Internally, in the military, you'd call it like an immediate action drill, like a set of things that you know you have to do as things are coming up. So these are rehearsed things. For example, where most other sections were preparing, say, to reduce their classified holdings, we'd already done that. So that was one less thing we had to do in that moment. It freed our sort of creative brain up to focus on the mission at hand. We refreshed our contacts, reached out to our contacts and started asking them, what were they seeing and hearing? Because the news, at least the regime-backed news in the country, is completely unreliable. You have social media, and that's one means of gathering information. But we also have our Overseas Security Advisory Council program, our country council. We talk to our partners to find out what they're seeing. We try to find out how many Americans do we have in not just Caracas, but the country. So you start sort of priming those contacts and dusting off those processes to get ready for what you know is coming.
And it sounds like this is not the movie type of shutdown where it's an attack on the embassy and you're running out the door. It seems like it was a very orchestrated, planned departure.
It was planned, certainly, and it was orchestrated. However, we have to plan for most dangerous course of action. You know, we have to plan for all, or at least consider all possible outcomes. And so while you were going through what was a, for the most part, orderly process, you still have to plan for the possibility of potential chaos. And when I say that, I don't want to sound alarmist. That's not what we do as a security professional, but you have to consider alternatives.
So how many people were still at the embassy when this all started?
Sure.
And then who leaves first? Who leaves last?
When we initially evacuated our non-essential personnel, we evacuated 122 families, pets, children over 2 days. And that left 23 of us behind to continue diplomacy until the very last day, which is about 8 weeks later.
One of the things that we get asked about frequently is how the State Department assists United States citizens or green card holders in the country with leaving the country in times of dangerous situations. Can you tell us a little bit more about
sure.
that?
So first of all, that's always an ongoing process. And that starts, and it's our consular colleagues who lead that process. And it starts by messaging. It starts by advising people to get enrolled into the STEP program. That's so that when consular has to send out notifications, they can reach those individuals, those Americans in country. It starts with travel advisories and warnings to let people know what the situation is in the country. And very often, for various reasons, American citizens and green card holders don't or can't leave. And so the idea is that you have at least a line of communication. In certainly folks can come to get passport services. In some cases, if they're destitute, they can get an emergency loan, an emergency passport, and things of this nature. So there are a variety of services that are provided to help protect them. But ultimately, we ask folks to heed the warnings, heed the advisories, and if they can get out of the country, get out of the country. And in that situation, as it was eroding, it was not a secret that the situation was bad in the country.
What did you do during the evacuation process? What was your role?
Well, as it turned out, our deputy RSO had to leave with that first group of folks because of her own family situation. It just worked out that way. And so I was the next most senior agent. I was acting deputy. And as the RSO described my job, he says, listen, I will be in meetings with the chargé with Washington. Your job is to run the day-to-day security program. That sounds like a lot, and it was in one sense, but we had a pretty well-oiled machine. So it was about keeping people focused, maintaining accountability, reporting up, and frankly, a lot of it was managing perceptions back in D.C. There's a filter. That filter is the media, for better or for worse. And I think we all saw firsthand that the information coming through U.S. media, mostly the world media, back to the United States, did not accurately reflect the reality of what was going on. And when I say that, I think folks depended on information from the previous situation in 2017, it was not exactly the same, frankly, not quite as violent. However, managing those perceptions, making sure people had accurate information, ensured that they would then not put requirements onto us on the ground that would further restrict us or further distract us from the very important work we had to do.
While you're doing this closing of the embassy, how do you maintain the security of the people and the facilities, the information? How does that shut down?
First, you established, they kept referring to what they call a TikTok, and not to be confused with the app. But so there was literally Washington's list was a very long list that included a lot of things. For example, one item I recall was remove the silverware and the art from the chief of missions residence. Not the most important thing, in my opinion. However, it is a thing, right? It's something to consider. And then, of course, within the embassy, I think the higher priority goes to certain national security equipment, classified or sensitive information. We don't want that to get into the regime's hands. You're still trying to run an embassy. With 23 Americans, most Marines, DS, front office, some other folks, there were protests almost daily. Managing people's perceptions of understanding of what's going on the ground. So I worked very closely with our locally employed staff to develop those daily reports and convey information in the most compelling and accurate way so that it could inform Washington. Because at that point, we were really the only people on the ground. There were no other assets on the ground. My RSO spent many, many hours every day with the chargé, in meetings and discussions with the National Security Council, the various stakeholders within the department. I mean, there were points when the secretary himself would direct, your folks are going to stay in the embassy, sleep in the embassy tonight. I mean, that was the level of discussion. And thankfully, because the RSO had earned that credibility with the front office from day one, he was included in all of those discussions, which meant that was more context that we had so we could take initiative on the ground as the circumstances changed.
And as you get through to those final 72 hours, can you walk us through those final moments, days?
Well, so we didn't know what the final days were going to be. We just carried on with our mission. Every day we had was another day to reduce our holdings, reduce that national security equipment that I talked about, to make arrangements to get equipment out of the country, thanks to the support of the department. You know, we had residents to manage, over 75 residences to manage, apartments, and a couple of houses. So maintaining accountability of that, working with the GSO section and the facilities section to sort of alarm that, but also allow trusted people to enter the apartments and make sure, take accountability of what was there. In some cases, look after pet fish or plants, because our folks left so abruptly, they truly thought that they were going to be coming back. And helping them understand that was less and less likely was a bit of a challenge. But we eventually got there. It's kind of the story of our lives as diplomatic security professionals. You're balancing security requirements with people's lives and their ability to function. And so you cannot completely ignore one for sake of the other. You have to find that balance. So while I would have preferred to focus on perhaps some other more security focused issues, I had to deal with people's concerns about their personal property, their pet fish, their plants, and we had to make accommodations for that. And that's fine, that's what we should do.
When you're shutting down an embassy or you're closing it down, mm-hmm. Are you physically locking everything down? Is the expectation that you're closing it down because we're coming back? Is the expectation that you're closing it down because we're not?
On the very last day, March 14th of 2019, after having taken out as much equipment as we could, or disabling other sensitive equipment, or working with our good colleague, our security engineering officer, who was very experienced and had done this in Russia previously, and one of the consulates. So we joke, we called him the closer, because he comes into the room and you'll probably be going on order departure soon. But very experienced. Great to have an SEO who understands that, because that SEO was managing the technical security part of the portfolio. And then they played a very important role in helping us sort of prioritize and then handle that national security equipment that we talked about. So that's, you're doing that. That's hours. That's time. You're destroying, when we run drills or we shred documents, when you're not in that situation, some folks think, well, why are we doing this? And you go through an experience like this and you realize you do those drills to enable you to do this quickly so you can move on to other things. So that's literally how we were spending our days.
And when did you know it was the last day?
I was up sleeping in my office like everyone else, sleeping in my office. We heard there was a Twitter statement from the president. And then the secretary shortly followed up with an official statement that we would be leaving. That was, I believe, on the 12th of March. And then we were out by the 14th. At 6 o'clock on the morning of the 14th, we had a ceremony. All of our local colleagues came, and the rest of us Americans, and we as a team took down the flag and folded the flag in a very dignified ceremony. We did it early in the morning to deny the regime the possibility of using that for propaganda. We did have to arrange through the regime police escort. The security forces were under their control. And then we took a very long motorcade to the airport, to a private hangar.
So embassy is closed. It's still closed.
Yes.
What happens now? We just have a closed embassy?
Our guard force, our RSO personnel are still protecting the embassy. They're still on the perimeter of that embassy. And as I understand it, there have been no, that I'm aware of, any attempts by the regime to penetrate the embassy. Our guards are still there. They report daily. In any country, as you know, under the Vienna Convention, it's the host country who's responsible for the protection of foreign diplomats in that country. And so we function within that environment even today. And we have a Venezuela Affairs Unit that is over and is based in Bogota. And the chargé, our former chargé, has been the ambassador for, I think, over a year now. And they still conduct diplomacy where they can.
It still sounds like a complicated situation.
Very.
Was there an emotional or, say, professional, personal toll that this experience gave you?
Yes, and I don't want to overstate it because, you know, we have colleagues who've gone through Kabul, certainly a much different situation. Our colleagues in Kyiv now, different situation. But there is an emotional toll. I think you come in on a personal level, you come in prepared to do your job and support the mission for whatever period of time. That doesn't happen. And so just sort of wrapping your mind around changing your expectations, that can be more challenging for some or more or less for others. For me, the bigger challenge was I got to see firsthand how our colleagues are, and not just our colleagues, but a large part of Venezuelan society really has an affinity for the United States, our values. There were strong cultural ties. And when you see or when you hear, you know, Venezuelans putting up still photos of our gigantic American flag, it was not a regulation flag, it was huge, and saying that that's a beacon to them, and you realize the connection that they have to our values and our country, it hits you. When we left, we were at the private hangar waiting, and everybody's talking, and it could have been any other day, until the immigration official said, okay, it's time. And then a few of our colleagues, you know, got emotional, and, you know, it's tough. It was very tough. But you have faith in our mission, you have faith in the Venezuelan people, and I have faith that we will be back.
Hareem, thank you for sharing these experiences, and thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.